This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Spiritual seekers have sought out wilderness for centuries. What is to be found in the desert and on mountaintops? Today in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, a conversation with theologian Belden Lane, author of The Solace of Fierce Landscapes. Lane has sought comfort in these landscapes. We'll talk with him about what moved him to seek them out, and we'll talk with him about what such inhospitable places offer those who seek them out. You can join the discussion with a telephone call this afternoon. Your questions and comments are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Our guest, Belden Lane, is professor of theological studies and American studies at St. Louis University. He is the author of Landscapes of the Sacred, Geography and Narrative in American Spirituality. His latest book is The Solace of Fierce Landscapes, Exploring Desert and Mountain Spirituality. Again, our phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, you can call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Belden Lane, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you.
You sought out wilderness, and I suppose anyone who seeks out wilderness is doing it for very personal reasons. What set you on course to seek wilderness?
Well, I guess a couple of things. You turn 40, and you begin to move from Freud to Jung in your life. Carl Jung, the psychologist of symbol. And I found myself drawn more and more to wilderness, to nature, backpacking alone, needing that as a way of thinking through my life. Fascinated also by the whole question of how geography relates to spirituality and personal growth, and wilderness in particular. And then along came an experience of my mother's being diagnosed as having bone cancer and having Alzheimer's disease as well. And accompanying her for the last 3 years of her life in a nursing home through all of that as a kind of metaphorical desert experience, and the combination of these things are what led me to the work that finally resulted in the book.
Mm. You write in The Solace of Fierce Landscapes that the desert, the time you spent in the desert, did for you what the nursing home did for your mother. Want to talk with us about that?
Yeah, the desert fathers and mothers, these were people who, Christians who went into the desert of southern Palestine, the Negev, or Egypt in the 4th-5th century. Again and again they said that you had to go to your cell. Your cell could teach you everything, and that there's a sense of needing at times to be boxed in our lives, I think, needing to be taken to the end of ourselves to a point where there's no escape, where you have to deal with those things that you've been running away from all of your life. And I think my mother's experience of being in that room in the nursing home, God-awful as it was in many ways, we all know the pain and the loneliness of nursing homes. And yet at the same time, I spent an awful lot of time there. It was an opportunity for her to find a centeredness in herself that was very healing. And my parallel entry into desert and wilderness terrain during that same time was just as healing for me.
Hmm. Would you read something from The Solace of Fierce Landscapes for
well,
us?
Well, there's one of the desert writers that I love is Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, that most people know as the author of The Little Prince, of course. There's an experience that I'd like to read of his that ties into the very locale of the desert Christians, and that may help us to get at something of the kind of harsh but beautiful and intriguing dimension of desert terrain. In December of 1935, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, on a mail flight between Paris and Saigon, crashed in the Libyan desert west of the Nile. It was in the same place that the desert fathers and mothers of the 4th century had withdrawn to seek the face of God in a landscape of emptiness. Saint-Exupéry's story of survival in his now classic book Wind, Sand, and Stars evokes the same desert discipline practiced by those who had preceded him there centuries earlier. No one lives for long in the desert without acquiring its crusty virtues of attentiveness and indifference. It was only because of these that Saint-Exupéry survived. What happened was that over a period of 3 days, he walked 125 miles without water through desert sands, stumbling at last half-dead into the path of a remote Bedouin caravan. He had been told that no one could survive more than 19 hours in the desert without water. The eyes then filled with a ghostly light, and death soon followed. What saved him were two things. First, he was meticulously observant of his surroundings, noticing an unusual northeast wind full of moisture, retarding the dehydration of his body and bringing a light dew he could collect on parachute silk. Second, he remained stubbornly indifferent to the panic, pain, and despair that preyed on his mind. Learning to be fiercely attentive, he learned also not to care, to ignore everything unnecessary, everything unrelated to the primary task of staying alive. When he was found at last by the Bedouins, he looked like some desert rat, crazed and blistered, unable to raise any saliva. His lips had sealed together with a kind of glue. His tongue felt as if it were made of plaster of Paris. There was a rasping in his throat, a horrible taste in his mouth. In the last hours, he had waited for the telltale cough to begin, the throat to close up, the shining spots to appear before his eyes, spots that would soon change to flames, and then the end. This, he had learned from others, was the pattern of desert death he could expect as his own. Now, it's that experience of desert that most of us never happily meet at all that is so different, I think, from the kind of romanticization of desert that we're much more accustomed to. And yet, it's placing yourself in a place that is indifferent, that in a sense doesn't give a damn about your presence, that the early desert Christians found to be a phenomenally healing and redemptive kind of place.
Hmm. So you're pulled out of your own concern with yourself. You've got to let go of that.
Right.
And also you have to connect with the landscape.
Yeah. That what the desert teaches best is that you cannot take yourself too seriously. There's a wonderful, really brief poem that Wallace McCrae, he's been on Prairie Home Companion several times. He's a cowboy poet from the American Southwest. And can I share it?
Sure.
It's a beautiful thing. It's called Reincarnation. And it expresses in a lovely way this core of desert thinking. What does reincarnation mean? A cowpoke asked his friend. His pal replied, "It happens when your life has reached its end. They comb your hair and wash your neck and clean your fingernails and lay you in a padded box away from life's travails. The box and you goes in a hole that's been dug into the ground. Reincarnation starts in when you're planted neath a mound. Them clods melt down just like your box and you who is inside, and then you're just beginning on your transformation ride. In a while the grass will grow upon your rendered mound, till someday on your moldered grave a lonely flower is found. And say a horse should wander by and graze upon this flower that once was you, but now's become your vegetative bower. The posy that the horse done ate up with his other feed makes bone and fat and muscle essential to the steed, but some is left that he can't use, and so it passes through and finally lays upon the ground this thing that once was you. Then, say by chance, I wanders by and sees this upon the ground, and I ponders and I wonders at this object that I found. I thinks of reincarnation, of life and death and such, and come away concluding, Slim, you ain't changed all that much." That is a wonderful expression, I think, of what the desert teachers wanted most to convey. That you, it's a landscape that forbids you taking yourself too seriously.
Yeah. And this thinking about, in this way helped you rethink Job.
Job in the Old Testament.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because Job needed to let go of his own problems.
Yeah, and that god-awful answer that comes at the end of the book, you know, you expect something like when good things happen to bad people, you want answers, and what God says to Job is just to ask him a series of questions about fierce landscapes. Job, where were you when I created the frost on the high mountains? What do you have to do with a goat in the hills giving birth? How can you explain anything? And it's a strange kind of answer that God gives to Job to turn him into a wild terrain and to say, Job, you don't have any answers. There aren't any answers sometimes, but there is a healing. There's something that can embrace you in the emptiness of the wilds. And I think that's a strange kind of comfort that proves to be a comfort for Job. He says at last, I've spoken with my mouth things that can't be said, and I'm left in silence and wonder.
Hmm. It puts the idea of prayer into a different perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah. I've got a big rub with an awful lot of popular spirituality and things on prayer. There's a tendency for people to think, especially out of a Christian context, but not just a Christian context, that God has very polite ears, and you've got to be careful what you say to God, and that you've got to say nice things. And there is, in the Jewish tradition, this wonderful practice of what's called chutzpah klapai shamaya, a boldness with respect to heaven. Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, shaking his fist to heaven and arguing with God. And that is a fascinating tradition that comes out of the Jewish background and to some extent within the Christian tradition as well. And I think prayer is a matter when the only prayer you got sometimes are those wretched prayers in the Psalms, for example, that talk about the agony of being abandoned by God and asking, in a sense, so where in the hell are you? If that's the only prayer you've got at times, that's the prayer you have to pray. And that may be the prayer God listens to more carefully than anything else. Yeah, I think we really need to rethink our attitudes about prayer.
Mm-hmm. At the outset of the first chapter, you share with readers thoughts from a Jewish scholar, John Levinson, and Wallace Stevens. It's a chapter titled Connecting Spirituality and the Environment. Now, here's the quote from Levinson. Geography is simply a visible form of theology. And from Stevens, we live in the description of a place and not in the place itself. Would you talk with us about these ideas and why you selected them?
Well, in that chapter, what I'm trying to do is kind of set a basis for asking why it's important to talk about spirituality in relationship to geography. Ortega y Gasset, the great Spanish philosopher, once said, "Tell me the landscape in which you live, and I'll tell you who you are." So convinced he was that where we find ourselves, the way we are molded by the terrain in which we live, is tremendously important. Now, I've lived for 21 years here in St. Louis. I grew up in Florida. I was always an ocean person. I've become a river person here. This is a meeting of waters, the Mississippi and the Missouri that come together. And I've come to value rivers and the kind of flowing motion of them that's had an important impact on me here. But so what I'm asking in that chapter is, how do we begin to think about how our experience of God and the way we put together the universe generally and respond to life, how is that affected not only by the place where we find ourselves, how we're molded by it, but also maybe by the places that we go to on retreat, the places we go to renew ourselves. And so I often ask students in doing workshops and classes if they know what kind of person they are. If you're a mountain person or a desert person or an ocean person or a city person, there are people who are rejuvenated, and I'm one of them too, by going to New York City. So that's the basic concern that I have in that chapter. So those quotes that I use at the beginning, Levinson's geography is simply a visible form of theology. He's overstating the case, of course, in order to make it well, that theology out of a Western tradition has always paid very careful attention to the land. In Judaism, the people of God are called to a land, to a geography, and that's inseparable from the way they experience God and develop their ethic and work out their lives. The quote from Wallace Stevens, "We live in the description of a place and not in the place itself," that suggests that there's, as well as the importance that the geography itself has on us, for example, the rivers and the effect they may have on me here in the St. Louis area, there's also a profound sense in which the imagination takes those places, runs with it, and creates interior landscapes that may be different from the exterior landscape, but are tremendously important in the way we fabricate meaning, the way we understand ourselves and the holy. Mm.
We live in the description of a place and not in the place itself. One of the things I found myself thinking about was how shaped we are by description, by language and words. And there are times when it's interesting to think about what we can gain by paring away at description.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, I think, a large part of what you're asking readers to do in The Solace of Fierce Landscapes.
Mm.
What would you say is to be gained by paring away, by living in a, putting oneself in a desert sort of mind, if not physically in the desert?
I'm not sure how you're asking that, but let me answer it on one level initially. This book is one that involves an awful lot of playfulness with language. I'm writing for two audiences in a sense, and asking them to move toward each other. One is the academy for scholars interested in religion. And the other is the reader who may be fascinated with the desert and mountain terrain and is interested about the symbolism involved in all of that. And so in the book, what I do, I have major chapters that are more scholarly in a sense. I hope that they're readable for everybody. But then what I call mythic landscape pieces that are personal essays that talk about my own experience of desert, my accompanying my mother through her dying, etc. And so what I'm doing with language is a kind of paring down of description, a kind of deconstruction and construction that's involved in the letting go of language and the discovering of new ways of imagining and describing reality for ourselves. And that's much of what I'm about in the book. Is that a response to your question?
Yeah, I think so. that is, well, I think also that that is an answer to the question, what is here for readers? I guess I'm interested in, you talk so much in the book about paring away, and I keep coming back to those words, that the desert demands less and less.
Yeah.
You write about prayer without language.
Yeah, yeah.
Those ideas are very interesting to me.
Yeah. What can we learn more about silence in our lives?
Mm-hmm.
What is curious to me is that out of this desert tradition of the early fathers and mothers comes a kind of pattern of prayer that's become more popular today, often called centering prayer. Father Thomas Keating, a Trappist at Snowmass Monastery in Colorado, and Basil Pennington at Gethsemane in Kentucky, they have both written important books dealing with this ancient pattern of prayer that is called contemplation in the Catholic tradition. And it's a way of moving through a pattern of prayer that leads you finally to a silence, kind of letting go of language and even of thoughts. In the classical tradition of Christian spirituality, there's kind of four steps of prayer. The first is lectio, the reading of Scripture in a prayerful way. Then there is meditatio, the meditation on what is read, carefully mulling it over in your mind and heart. Then there's oratio, prayer proper, as we would think of it. That is, what desires come to your mind? Who do you find yourself wanting to pray for? What are you thinking of growing out of this reflection on the text? And then the fourth and last step is contemplatio, contemplation, where you move through and beyond the text and all of these images and all of these thoughts and concerns to a quietness, a utter silence, and letting go of all the thoughts, even letting go of anything that might come into your mind. They often will make use of a what they call a prayer word, a single phrase or word like, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, the Jesus prayer that's said over and over again in silence. And even letting go of that as you calm your mind and release all the images and give yourself a few moments utterly alone with God without any thoughts or words interfering at all. It's the kind of image. I've been married 31 years to my wife. I love that woman a thousand times more than when I'm married her 31 years ago. And we spend a lot of time in silence together, alone, and just enjoying each other's presence. And that's the image that the desert fathers and mothers are inviting us to. What can you gain from just utter silence and letting go of all language in prayer?
Mm. We're talking this afternoon with theologian Belden Lane. His latest book is Exploring... The Solace of Fierce Landscapes, Exploring Desert and Mountain Spirituality. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Your calls are welcome this afternoon, questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Or you can call us toll-free if you're outside Champaign. And the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. This tradition of contemplation. In this tradition, there is a metaphor of God as desert or desert mountain. What is the significance of the metaphor?
Of that particular metaphor?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it goes back, I argue in the book, to the 4th century, to a Cappadocian church father named Gregory of Nyssa. He lived in eastern Turkey. And his great image of the Christian, the spiritual life and growth as a person was that of Moses going into the desert, up the mountain, and into a dark cloud. And so that movement from desert to mountain to cloud becomes kind of three steps in the spiritual life that come to be developed in the tradition. And each of those are steps into a greater entry into God, God's presence. And again, you kind of have two traditions in doing theology in the Christian tradition and in Jewish tradition and every other religious tradition for that matter. You've got the one side of people who are saying all that can be said about God and writing great tomes like Thomas Aquinas and so forth in doing that. But then you always have a counter tradition of people who are saying, yeah, but there's always something more that you can't say about God, that you can never capture the wholeness of what the holy is about. And so these are people who keep saying that God is a desert. God is a high mountain that cannot be climbed. God is beyond all of our language, beyond all of our capacity to ultimately understand. And theology in the Jewish tradition, that's called Halakha and Haggadah. The spelling out theology in language, and then the in kind of traditional discursive language, and then the telling of story, the reaching for metaphor, the use of broken language to try to talk about what ultimately can't be talked about. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they use this image of God as desert or mountain or mm-hmm. cloud again and again. It's kind of corrective to remind theologians that they don't have control of things as much as they might like to think they do.
Do you have a foot in each camp?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think that an academic theologian like myself absolutely has to do both. That you've got to do the discursive work of taking texts seriously and doing the scholarship, but at the same time, you've got to come again and again to a recognition that you ain't even begun. And that you find yourself vulnerable, broken, and reaching right along with everybody else.
Mm. Let's take a call. We've okay. got a caller waiting for us on line 4 in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Extremely interesting discussion. You were talking about prayer a bit ago, and you mentioned prayer without language, and my mind began to go to the mystical tradition of the Christian Church, and I believe persons such as Saint Teresa de Avila and Thomas a Kempis, perhaps Kierkegaard. I wonder if you could distinguish the tradition of mystical prayer as over against maybe, I realize that you can't, there may be more than just mystical versus traditional prayer, but could you discuss that concept, please?
Yeah, what you mentioned some of the great classic mystics in the Christian Catholic tradition, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, Meister Eckhart, and the Cloud of Unknowing, that's a 14th century piece done in England. All of these are very important in the book as I try to recover that tradition. What's interesting is that in every case, these are people who are using vivid imagery to try to talk about what can't be talked about, and they're always working to try to run out of language, to go over the edge, and pushing their readers over the edge, and trying to get something of a handle on what they realize ultimately they'll never be able to handle at all. And that's what's so delightful in reading these great classic writers in the tradition.
Let me ask one more question.
Yeah.
That sort of runs counter to a kind of technocracy and super-rationalism that we find all around us, doesn't it? I mean, it's a good... I agree with what you're saying, but it seems like it's...
Yeah, it sounds anti-intellectual, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There's some things that you just cannot know. And I find myself I'm writing a book about the mystical tradition in terms of desert mountain terrain, and I got some 274 pages in it, and so I'm using an awful lot of words to talk about what can't be talked about. So you're just thrown into paradox continually. I don't want to reject the intellectual tradition at all, but I want to question it, that again and again we've got to recognize that discursive language and purely linear, rational language is not adequate in any discipline, theology most of all, but I think that's often true even in the sciences as well.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You mentioned your wife of 31 years.
Right.
This experience of your experiences of going to desert places, to these fierce landscapes, what has the experience meant for your marriage and your family?
That's a good question. There's a deep sense, this is a psychological truth as well as a theological truth, that you have to let go of what you really want to hold on to. And there has been, in the last 10, 15 years of my life, you know, in my midlife journey, I'm 55, there has been a profound sense of seeking solitude, of entering into myself and beyond myself in wilderness. And what that has done has not been to make a monk out of me at all, but has been to allow me a freedom to come back and to embrace what I really love, to make choices that I've really wanted to make, and to reaffirm my wife and children in a way that I'd never done before. And so I think that's another one of the paradoxes here, that the life of prayer that seems to be very individual and alone and solitary is one that inevitably always plays back and forth with community, and that the one leads you into the other inevitably.
Mm. So a retreat for a time into wilderness should bring you back to connection.
And if it doesn't, something's wrong there. If you're, and that was true even of the desert fathers and mothers. St. Anthony, 3rd century, goes into the desert. He spends like 18 years there. But then he opens himself, making himself available, and the people constantly coming out to him so that he's reaching back to the community and that... Thomas Merton, another great example of that continual interplay, that the monk and anybody who wants to practice a life of prayer will have to constantly be pulled between the journey inward and the journey outward.
Hmm. Does one need literally to go to a fierce landscape, to go to wilderness in order to come to a new awakening?
Yeah, not at all. Thank you. That's a wonderful question. I do not believe that in the least. There are people I know who have lived desert experience and have never been to geographical desert terrain in their lives. What I'm talking about desert, and I talk about real deserts and real mountains, like Sinai in this book, but I'm also talking about desert mountain experiences in a metaphorical way, those peaks and veils in our experience, as James Hillman, the great archetypal psychologist, spoke of, the mountaintop experiences and the desert moments of despair, it would seem. There are times in our lives, every one of us, when desert comes to us and is not asked for and we didn't seek it out, and what we do with it may be tremendously important at that point. And so that's the kind of desert I'm speaking of, just as much as geographical terrain in Nevada or New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. We have another call. Perhaps it's the same caller we talked to a moment ago, because the call is also from Eureka. A caller on line four. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, different caller. Hello.
Yeah, different one. Well, I wonder if your guest might ever have experienced the California deserts in the springtime. They talk about the fierce desert, things like that, very plain, but there's quite a bloom in the desert. It's amazing how extensive it might be, and I just wondered if you might ever experience that.
Yeah, Isaiah speaks of the desert blossoming like a rose or a crocus, and you're exactly right. There's a leanness about desert terrain. The desert that I'm most familiar with, that I love and get to as often as I can, is northern New Mexico, above Abiquiu, Santa Fe, toward Ghost Ranch and so forth. But that's a high desert country. That it has a profound beauty to it, especially as you say, in the spring. And yes, we do the desert injustice if we simply characterize it as nothing but salt flats and iodine bush. Absolutely, it can be utterly beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. A bit earlier, you mentioned your discomfort with sweet custardy visions of God. This is something that you write about in The Solace of Fierce Landscapes. Maybe you would share with us some reflection on how and why, to quote you, we've come to a place where we want, quote, our deities to be housebroken and eminently companionable.
Yeah, I'm kind of reacting to some things that you find in popular spirituality on bookshelves and bookstores that talk about how to be self-realized, how to discover the whole of your potential, how to be all you can be without joining the army. And I think that much of that is so self-absorbed. And so anxious to make God at our bidding, and that there's a kind of fierceness that's altogether missing there, that can be profoundly healing. Maybe the best way to express that is telling another brief story, if I can. One of the stories that were typical of what the Desert Fathers used in their teaching, Macarius the Egyptian was a great 4th century abbot of a monastery west of the Nile. And one time there's a young man who came out to the monastery and said that he wanted to become holy. He wanted to get spirituality and get it fast. And what was he supposed to do? And so the older monk told him to go to the cemetery. He told him he'd find it over the hill down the way. And to spend the day abusing the dead, yelling at them for all it was worth, even throwing stones, calling them names, etc. Well, the young man thought this was a kind of strange order, but he did as he was told and then came back the end of the day to the teacher. And Macarius said, "Well, what did they say to you?" "Nothing at all," the brother replied. "They were dead as doornails." Well, Macarius said, I want you to go back tomorrow then. Spend tomorrow there and praise them this time. Call them apostles, saints, righteous men and women. Think of every compliment that you possibly can. Well, once again, the next day, the young man did as he was told and came back to the cloister that evening. And Macarius said, "Well, what did they say to this time?" "Well, they didn't say anything more than they did yesterday." The fellow answered, "Ah," said Abba Macarius, "they must indeed be holy people. You insulted them and they did not reply. You praised them and they did not speak. Go and do likewise, my friend, taking no account of either the scorn of men and women or their praises, and you too will be a holy person." You see, I think what the desert teaches, the great two questions that the desert asks are, what do you learn to ignore? And then what are you able to learn to love? And until we start ignoring ourselves, for one thing, and ignoring all the careful concern to cultivate a reputation and all the things to be self-realized and accepted by our culture, etc., until we learn what's necessary to ignore, we're not going to be able to be set free to really ask, now what can we love? And those are the two questions that I think the desert in its fierceness and emptiness is able to raise so well.
Mm. There was an article in the New York Times in July about a race, the Badwater race. This is a marathon through Death Valley.
I guess I've heard something about that.
And I was curious as to what you might think about it. This article, which I have in front of me, the headline is, Will to Suffer Draws Runners to the Desert. And this is a many-day, well, I don't know how many days it is, several-day-long race, apparently. It runs for 135 miles. And one of the racers is quoted in this article. Her name is Lisa Smith, and she's quoted as saying, "Something about this race just gives you a power that you have to find within yourself. Once you've done it, nothing seems that difficult anymore." Do you have any comment, any insight to share with us about this kind of pushing?
Pushing the edge.
Yeah.
I kind of have two reflections, I guess, immediately. One, spoke of the will to suffer as the title of the mm-hmm. article. I guess I'm a little wary of a sadomasochism and you found that in rare examples, even in the desert, early desert monastic experience of people who kind of tortured themselves for the glory of God or something. I think that's something that the best people in the tradition always warned against. And suffering is not ever a good thing just in itself. And to go and run, I don't know how many miles through Death Valley, just to make yourself miserable, doesn't gain any particular merit with God in my thinking, whatever. On the other hand, though, that experience, I'm not thinking of a run through the desert, but of those times in our lives when we find ourselves involuntarily running through the desert, coming to the end of ourselves, having even metaphorically come to a point in our lives when it seems as if we've almost died, we've lost everything. The people who are freest in our society are those who have nothing to lose. People who, in a sense, spiritually I'm speaking, if you've already died, you can't die again. There's a freedom, being set free from concerns to win the approval of others and so forth. There is a great sense of power that is available through having gone through those experiences at times in our lives that are utterly stripping. And finding somehow that we survive, that we were not somehow alone through that. But having been there, you never can be quite threatened in the same way again. So I those would be the kind of two mm-hmm. sides of response that I'd make to that.
Yeah. What's been the reaction to the Solace of Fierce Landscapes in among your colleagues?
Well, you know, it's wonderful on the two levels. I'm a member of the American Academy of Religion, a huge body of religious scholars that meet every November, among all the others, that's devoted to this book, and a group of scholars gathering together to talk about it and talk about the kinds of edges that it probes. And so I expect to be taken apart in some respects there, but I'm profoundly honored that they did that. And then even more important to me in terms of reaction than that and the response of the Academy would be some letters and calls from people who out of nowhere who said, you told my story. I've been there. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been in that desert in terms of their own life experience. And that's the deepest honor, of course, that any author ever wants to get.
Mm. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Belden Lane has been our guest. He is a professor of theological studies and American studies at St. Louis University. His latest book is The Solace of Fierce Landscapes, Exploring Desert and Mountain Spirituality.